So we're going to pick up where we left off and just continue on in the saga of the book of Genesis and just continue to hear more stories, stories of God's faithfulness, stories of God's plan, stories of how people trusted in him and also didn't trust in him as the stories may go, and hopefully learn many lessons for our lives about who God is and how we could relate to him and how we could trust him and what he's doing in this world. So if you remember, last time we finished off Abraham's life. We finished off in chapter 25 with Abraham's death. And if you remember, in chapter 25, verse 12, it says, "Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son." And so from 25:12 to 18, there's this short little section. Remember we said that there's 10 of these sections. These are the generations of. And so in 25:12 through 18, there's kind of a, I guess you could call it a transitionary section where Abraham dies and it's concluded with this life of Ishmael and kind of what became of Ishmael. But if you remember there, the purpose of the author, I think, and we're going to obviously get into this a lot more this week, is to show God's election, even in that, and God's plan and his purpose, that Isaac was the son of promise. And so you quickly kind of, if you will, the camera pans to Ishmael just for a second to then go back and put the spotlight on Isaac to show the fact that God has chosen Isaac and not Ishmael. And we'll do the exact same thing in just a little bit. We'll finish this. These are the, you know, if you go to 25:19, right, then these are the records of the generations of Isaac. So we pan back to Isaac. We'll finish off this section. We get to the end of it. We'll close off that part of the story, and then we'll look at Jacob and Esau, and it'll pan to Esau before, well, just go all the way there in chapter 36. Chapter 36 says, "Now these are the records of the generations of Esau, that is Edom," and just continues on, chapter 36 is that, and then look at chapter 37, verse 2, "These are the records of the generations of Jacob." So you have Ishmael real quick, focus on Isaac. Then you go Esau real quick, focus on Jacob. And of course, I think a major emphasis in this is God's sovereignty in working out his plan, his choosing of his line. And of course, you know, that traces all the way back to Genesis chapter 3 and the seed of the woman that we're continuing to trace out. And so within that, a large part of this shows that God has sovereignly chosen his nation. They are his, by his divine working, his choice, his election. And so that should be an encouragement to Israel, that they were chosen out of all these, you know, other nations and their line. And once again, just how they were special within God's place and plan. And of course, you know, application to us as well, just as God has chosen us. And so just the reminder of God's amazing grace that he would choose to save and choose to work through those whom he will. And so that just kind of maybe brings us up to speed. And so we finished off the life of Abraham, the man of faith. Once again, we saw the climax in chapter 22 when he sacrificed his son Isaac. And then we kind of, the story kind of came down for a landing smoothly. And now we pick up in chapter 25, verse 19. And we'll pick up there. Okay, so chapter 25, verse 19. "Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to Yahweh on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And Yahweh answered him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, 'If it is so, why then am I this way?' So she went to inquire of Yahweh. And Yahweh said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples shall be separated from your body. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger.' When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterward his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. And so his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And when Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am about to die, so what use is the birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Okay, so we start off here. This is, you know, what happened to Isaac. As we start off, obviously, in the first couple of verses there, there does seem to be an emphasis on prayer. You'll notice as it begins in verse 20 that, I should say 21, that Isaac's wife Rebekah was barren. So Isaac prayed to Yahweh on behalf of his wife, and because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And there's an emphasis, because the word there for prayed, it's almost more like pleaded. And the word there for Yahweh answered him, it's the same word, but kind of in the inverse. But there's a depth. The author's really trying to make an emphasis and a connection there, is that Isaac pleaded and Yahweh was persuaded, using the same word, but a different nuance of it. And so it starts off with Isaac's, I guess if you could say this way, Isaac's continuing in his father's footsteps, trusting in Yahweh. We'll see that, well, we saw that already in chapter 24, I believe. Where was that? No, 25. Yes, 25:11. And it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived by Beer Lechai Roy. And just so much of the emphasis here, with throughout this whole section, is Abraham died. We saw that last week. But God blessed Isaac. God's plan was continuing. And so we're going to continue to watch. Okay, Abraham's off the scene now. Now what's going to happen to this plan? What's going to happen to this promise? Is it going to continue on? And so you start off, the spotlight now focuses on Isaac, and you see that he's trusting in Yahweh. He's praying to Yahweh. He's following the God of his father. We'll see, once again, shortcomings in his life as well. But certainly as it starts off, that's the first thing you learn, in one sense, about Isaac. The first time he acts in this book is to be seeking the Lord and praying and God answering. And we're going to see so clearly that the blessing is transferred to Isaac, because he's the chosen son. He's the seed of promise. God's promises will not fail. They will continue on. And so we'll continue to see that throughout the book. And so God answers his prayer. He allows his wife Rebekah to conceive. And really the heart of this section is verse 23, this, I guess you could call it, this oracle that God gives to her. You see also just that she sought the Lord. She, in verse 22, went to inquire, but really the idea, she sought the Lord. She sought after him, and once again speaks of her faithfulness to seek God in prayer. And so right, in two verses back to back, you have this couple seeking Yahweh, and God coming back with this oracle. Now, once again, I think, at this point in time, there's, and I think it's brought out in the New Testament, but it's good to note it even from here, there's nothing, how do I say this? There's nothing prompting God saying, the younger's going to serve the older, right? There's nothing that, causes him to do this. It's kind of, I guess if I could put it this way, it's kind of out of the blue, right? Isaac prays that his wife would conceive. She feels some sort of a struggle within her, and that's going to be, in one sense, a paradigm for the rest of these two children's lives. and for the countries that flow out of them. This, even the word there for struggle is like, it's a pretty intense word. And obviously throughout Israel's history, Edom was one of their prime enemies. And so it starts off all the way back in the womb, if you will. But I think the point I was going to get at here is, you know, they're in the womb and haven't even come out yet or anything, and God gives this oracle that the older is going to serve the younger. And it just points out God's choice. He decided to choose this. He decided that this is the way it was going to be. And it really sets the stage for everything that follows. Okay, and we need to really keep that in mind, because we'll see Jacob doing some things to kind of, if you will, to try to seize what this oracle already has said is going to happen. We'll see that. We'll see as these stories unfold that he and his mom kind of scheme to try to make sure that this happens, as opposed to trusting in the Lord that this is going to happen. And so you see, in one sense, their lack of faith. And throughout a lot of this section, we're going to see a lot of distrust. We're going to see a lot of non-ideal, faithful, unfaithful behavior in a lot of different ways. But the point is still the same, that God is going to bless his line. He's going to bless those whom he has chosen. He's going to work out his plan and purpose. And yet at the same time, what we see is that there's repercussions. And so we'll keep coming. This oracle, just remember, it's not because the boys were at enmity or whatever necessarily, but God, it's way back in the womb, God kind of declares that this is how it's going to be. And so, really, there should have been trust in that. But we'll see how various members within this family react to this oracle and how they should have reacted to it. And so, really, the first part of this here is kind of background information in 19 through 26, just kind of introducing us to Jacob and Esau, who are going to be the main characters through a lot of this story. Okay, any questions there about 19 through 26? Just kind of setting the stage, once again, that oracle being really the central part to emphasize that, you know, they should have really grabbed a hold of that. This is God speaking to them, but they apparently didn't really trust in that. Any other just comments or observations? Okay, so we'll dive into 27 through 34 then. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. So right off the bat, you have this kind of this strong contrast between these two guys. Well, you could say that Esau was kind of a man of adventure, maybe. Outdoors kind of a man, not to put a negative spin on that, but certainly here there's somewhat of a contrast, whereas definitely Jacob, when it says he's a peaceful man, the word is actually, it's very interesting because it's used in a different kind of a way here, but it actually means almost like upright or righteous almost, but it's certainly not the nuance that it's taken here, but it has this idea that he's kind of at peace. He's the contemplative kind of guy. He's the guy that's maybe meditating on God. It starts off with kind of this picture painting the two of these sons. And it starts off with this background in verse 28 that Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And right off the bat, you got like this favoritism going on in the family. It's interesting, one of the commentators pointed out that throughout all this section, you never see like the four of them in a scene together. It's always like Jacob and Esau, or Jacob and Rebekah, or Isaac and Jacob, or Isaac and Esau, and like there's always like this plotting scheme. It's kind of a dysfunctional family, is almost the way it's portrayed here. And it's interesting, right off the bat, this favoritism that they have, and Isaac, even though he's the son of promise, but as we'll see here, somewhat is just influenced by his taste, just by his stomach, if you will. And we'll see how that plays out later within the book, but certainly it starts off even here. And so as the story moves on, and when Jacob had cooked stew verse 29, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. It's likely, as you kind of read throughout this section, read about Jacob and Esau, it's likely that Jacob was kind of conniving here. So it's interesting. Really, in this section, certainly Esau is the one who is kind of the villain, I guess, if you're going to put it that way. But there's no heroes, right? Esau is the one that did the worst, but Jacob didn't do much better, right? Jacob wasn't necessarily trusting in the Lord. He's deceiving and conniving. And yes, he was the one that was, if you will, had his eyes on spiritual long-lasting benefits and not just the here and now. But to get there, we'll see this throughout this story, to get there, he doesn't live an upright life trusting in the Lord. He's willing to try to manipulate, probably is the best word, to manipulate, to trick, to deceive, to make it happen. And so this whole section is kind of an enigma where you have no one in the family really trusting in the Lord as they should, and as a result, there's all kinds of problems that take place. And so, you know, when I first read through this, you're kind of like, well, Esau's the bad one and Jacob's the good one, but then you're like, there's this tension. It's like the whole thing is never resolved until finally at the very end of the Jacob-Esau saga here, finally they reconcile at the end. But throughout the rest of all these little stories that kind of piece along as you move towards the end of this section, you never really have resolution. And I think it points to the fact that, you know, in one sense of two negative examples, and not a negative example and a positive example. Okay, and so Jacob here has kind of set up this situation potentially just in his conniving. And verse 30, and Esau said to Jacob, please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there. And it's kind of funny just the way he says it. It's like, red stuff, I need some, I want some. And just the way it's even portrayed here is very, like, just carnal, I guess. Barbaric. What's that?
Barbaric.
Yeah, almost, I don't know if I go so far as barbaric, but he's certainly more concerned about his stomach than anything else. And so, you know, he's famished, and so he's like, hey, I want the red stuff. Give me some of that stew. But Jacob is like, first sell me your birthright. You know? And so, like, it seems like he's got this whole thing set up and schemed, potentially. He was like, all right, you know, I got the right opportunity. In one sense, you kind of look up to Jacob because he cared about what was important, right? He wanted to be used in God's plan and be a part of God's plan for blessing and all this, but yet the way he got there was not the right way. And, you know, theoretically, he shouldn't have had to go to these measures, right? Go all the way back to the oracle, right? God said the older is going to serve the younger, and right off the bat, there should have been just this trust that God is going to work this out in his timing and his way. But somehow, both Rebecca and Jacob are like, I need to seize this. I need to make it happen. I need to, whatever it takes, get there. And of course, the result is going to be Esau hates Jacob, right? You have something you were going to say?
Well, why do we assume that Jacob is seeking the birthright in as far as, why isn't it just like a mercenary wanting? Because wouldn't the birthright, he wouldn't be entitled to the wealth of his father.
Sure.
So to me, that's not necessarily, to me it doesn't mean that he is seeking a higher good, let me put it that way.
Right.
Yeah, to me, it could be just, you know, the bottom line.
Yeah, it could be really focused on that. I was told they were going to make a nation out of me. Let's see how fast we can make this happen, you know? Let's make this happen in my lifetime. Be a king, something like that.
Yeah, it definitely could be, but I guess contrasted with Esau, you do see that Jacob is a little bit more forward-thinking. He's a little
He values it.
He values
for whatever it is.
And he values the birthright, which is good. You know, he wants, even we'll see, he wants to go, he wants the blessing, right? We'll get to that story where he tricks you know, Isaac into blessing him. He wants God's blessing. He wants his father's blessing. He sees the value of long term, but yet how he gets there is not necessarily good. So I guess I'm kind of maybe in one sense reading this story in light of that story too, in the sense that it seems like this manipulative driving seems to characterize all of Jacob's life. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, it could even be a little bit more simpler than that, just the competition between brothers, you know, just in a family sense. You know, I have my own brother, we always try to one-up each other, and it could just be part of that competition, not necessarily making him trying to get what's coming to him faster. It could just be...
Yeah, certainly that's a part of it, absolutely. Absolutely. That's good. But so, you know, as we see, Jacob is kind of ready for this situation. He's kind of connived, and so he's like, give me some of the red stuff. He's like, first, all right? He's like, no, I'm not going to give you any stew until, you know, you got to first do this. You got to first give me your birthright. That first emphasis there is very clear in the text. It's like he's not going to give up his bargaining power, right? This is not the kind thing to do, right? Your brother's famished. It's like, no, I'm not giving you my stew. You know, he's once again, he's not portrayed like Abraham in some of those stories where, like, he's the one that's generously giving Lot the better choice, knowing that God is still going to fulfill his promise. That's not how Jacob is portrayed here. And so once again, it's not the comparison of, like, good to bad, but it's like bad to worse. And so it's just kind of funny to me how this isn't really resolved at this point. And so Esau, of course, you know, once again, Jacob being bad, Esau is worse. You know, I'm about to die. What use is the birthright to me? He's so focused on just the here and now only. He's carnal. He's worldly. All he cares about is his belly. He doesn't even care about his birthright. I mean, he can't wait, you know, I don't know how long it would take him, 15, 20, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever, to go find some food somewhere else. He's like, no, I need it now or else I'm going to die. And so, but so, you know, he says this to Jacob, but what's Jacob's response again? First, swear to me, right? He's like, twice, it's like, first, I will not give you any of this stew until you swear to me that the birthright is mine, right? So you just see, like, he's setting his brother up big time, you know, and just his conniving nature. And so finally he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank, and he rose and went on his way. It's just kind of a series of events, right? It's just, he ate, drank, rose, and left. Just boom, 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 boom. It's like, all he cares about is the food. Not, you know, no mention of the birthright, nothing. Except for then it ends with, then Esau, thus Esau despised his birthright. Really? Despised is a good translation, but it probably even goes beyond that to he thought of his birthright of little value. He held it in contempt. You know, it was worthless to him. You know, and I think it's probably more of a summary statement of just his attitude towards his birthright. And once again, whether we put Jacob, don't go there with this. Like, are we putting Jacob in a good light because he was seeking the birthright? But just think about Esau for a second, right? His birthright, God's blessing, the birthright, all of that was God's plan to bless the world, right? He should have known, right? They're grown men at this time, that about the promise to Abraham, his grandfather, and to Isaac, his father, that God was going to bless the world through them and multiply them. And obviously, it's so much tied to the birthright, right? And to the righteous line and to the heir and to the promises. And so, you know, you think birthright, what's the big deal? He sold his birthright, you know. As you think, well, not that. But really, he gave up everything that God was seeking to do through his family. And he had no concern whatsoever about the promises of God. Right? You would think he had heard about everything that God had promised to do through his grandfather. Right? He should know those things. And so you just think about Esau for a second. Of course, Hebrews elaborates on this and just, if you will, just rags on Esau and says, This was terrible. He was so worldly. He was so short-sighted. He didn't care at all about the plan of God. And so certainly he, I would say, is the emphasis in this section as the villain is probably not the best word, but just the person who kind of receives the spotlight as the one who didn't do what he should have done.
What exactly is Hebrews emphasizing when it says, you know, when it talks about how he was rejected when he didn't have a chance to repent? Like, what exactly is it emphasizing? Because I know it's a chapter about expressing the faith in chapter 11. It says, see that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau.
I would probably translate that profane. And so I think the idea is like his because there's a huge emphasis on Hebrews on short-sightedness and looking only at earthly things versus looking at things of spiritual value and eternal value. And so that's why I would say that the author of Hebrews sees what Esau did here, and he says he was worldly-minded. All he cared about was stew. He didn't care about God's plan to bless the world. That's how the author of Hebrews seems to interpret this. And as you come back to here, you know, the summary statement of this whole section is Esau despised his birthright. He held it as little value. And by implication, the birthright is of magnificent value, especially because of God's plan, promises in his plan. And Esau thought of it as nothing.
Well, do you think that in verse 17, it says, you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it. It's like, this is an analogy for you in salvation. You spend all of your life being worldly. Is that a correct...
Yeah, I think so.
You spend all of your time being so earthly and short-sighted in your life, and you're going to find yourself like Esau in eternity.
Right.
Not when you need your birthright blessing, but when you arrive before God.
Right. And the author of Hebrews, and this is probably a good point to bring in too, the author of Hebrews, in a little bit, we're going to talk about the blessing. We have the birthright and the blessing. The author of Hebrews kind of, I wouldn't say combined the two or mixed up the two, but he kind of saw the two events as similar. And so, or one as causing the other. And so he kind of just summarized them both together. Whereas in Genesis, it's more, there's more of a space and it's more elaboration on the two. But certainly it flows out of, you know, this text. And then the one we'll get to in just a bit. Okay? Those are good observations and questions. Do we see the point here? I think it's fairly straightforward, right? That Esau didn't care about God's plan to bless the world, and so ultimately he's not going to be a part of it.
Well, essentially that's what we need to remember, right? Because that's sort of the point for us. We don't have birthrights and first blessings or anything like that anymore, but we surely have to pay attention to not being worldly and short-sighted.
Jacob kind of do the same thing, though, in some aspects, because, I mean, even though he had the right intentions, Esau did it a different way, but obviously he was like, well, I do want what God wants. I'm going to do it my way.
Exactly.
Instead of relying on God's way. So it's kind of funny how they're both doing the same thing, but different ways.
Right? Exactly. And that's what, to me, that if it causes tension for you, it does for me. I think that's the point. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're like, you want, like, the good and the bad, you know, but you're exactly right. They're both not trusting God. Esau's in one sense doing a worse job of it, you know, than Jacob, because at least Jacob wants, in one sense, something that's good, but as you said, he doesn't trust God to give it to him, and so he goes about it his own way.
I was trying to figure this out in my own head. I guess maybe it's they're both operating from a self-centered perspective.
Right.
It's like helping somebody for the good, the benefit that it's going to bring to you, not for the actual meeting the need or helping somebody for that. That is the end in and of itself, but for whatever it brings about for you.
Right. Yeah, certainly.
Could it be an indication that Jacob is somewhat of a mystic? He's like, I'm not really sure how this works, but I know it's like powerful, and I know it's good, and so I'm just going to try and get him to sell it to me, and then later I'm going to steal it from him when I, like, dress up and do, you know, like, Eden wasn't thinking about that before, probably. He needed the birthright first, and then his mom hatched the plan. But, like, couldn't it kind of make him, you could sort of paint it like that, like, he's like this mystic, I know this is powerful, and I know, like, God's promised it, and I'm, like, this child of blessing, we're this, like, special family, and, like, you know, brothers, I want to be, like, I want to make sure I get this.
Yeah, it's hard to know, like, you know, exactly what all he was thinking, and so I don't want to go too much down that road, but certainly, I guess if I could put it this way, you watch the life of Jacob, ultimately you'll see his life transform by the end of the story. Right? But certainly as you start off here, he's not doing things out of right motivations and out of trusting in God, and ultimately God has to wrestle with him to humble him, right? And we'll see that, not this week, but later in the story. And so as it starts off, he wanted the right thing, but not for the right reasons. Or I should even probably say it different. He wanted the right thing, but he wasn't willing to trust God to get it.
It's funny because he wrestles with God, and then he wins, and then he demands a blessing, even after his hip is out. He always wants a blessing. He's always going after it.
Yeah.
He would have thought he could have seen that from his grandpa's life. In Abraham, although he waited all those years, and then finally, like, okay, let's do something about it, you know, and we wind up with the Ishmael factor.
Exactly. It's a lesson throughout all of here, is the major emphasis of this book is you need to trust God. You know, if God tells you something, he gives you an oracle, you know, a message from God, this weighty message, okay, you can rely on it. You don't need to, like, make it happen some way by undermining and cheating and lying and stealing and et cetera, right? You can trust in God. It's a huge message. Huge message from this section. All right, we better keep rolling, because I don't want to just take forever to get through this. But let's move on to chapter 26. Some great lessons there for us in 25. And I love chapter 26. Hopefully, you'll, as soon as we read it, things that we've already learned in the book of Genesis will immediately start popping into your mind, because it's very similar to what's happened to Abraham and teaches us a lot of those same lessons. So let's pick up here. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And Yahweh appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your seed I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven. I will give your seed all these lands, and by your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham listened to me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Isaac lived in Gerar. Let's just kind of stop there for a second. Right off the bat, this should just teach us very, very clearly and unmistakably that the blessing is passed on to Isaac. Right? I mean, when we come back here to Isaac and, you know, Abraham's dead, and just the same language, God says to him, you know, "I will bless you, and in you and in your seed and in your descendants, I will give this land and bless the world through you." Once again, the promise didn't die with Abraham. It's transferred on to his son. God is continuing on this line to continue to keep working. And so we see very, very clearly here that, once again, he swore to Abraham, it's not going to fail. It's going to continue on to the descendants until there is this mighty nation. And obviously, just in verse 3 there, that key statement, "I will establish the oath which I swore." You know, God swore to Abraham. Abraham depended upon this promise, this oath. And now, as Isaac continues on, it's going to be established and made firm. Because God is going to keep his word. And I love verse 5. Verse 5 is just such a key verse. It's because of what Abraham did, right? As you go back to the Abraham narrative that we've been walking through, it's over and over. God says, "You did this, you've been faithful, you know, I swear by myself, I'm going to do this, I will not lie." You can't make it any more clear, right, in the chapters that we've walked through that God said to Abraham, I will do this. And so God says to Isaac, it's not even because of you, right? It's because of Abraham. It's because of his faith, I am going to keep my word and my promises to him. And it's even interesting here, the words that are used. He heard me and kept my charge, my commandments and my statutes and my laws. Really, very, should ring a bell and make you think of Deuteronomy, make you think of the law. And it really is characterizing Abraham as a man who kept the law. And obviously, it was before the law, but it's kind of painting him with that kind of a picture. And the obvious message being, if you trust in me, you have faith in me, and you obey me, keep my law, you will be blessed. Which is, of course, the lesson that the Israelites needed to hear. Right? As they're going into the promised land, they have God's constitution, they have God's law. They needed that lesson. Trust God, trust and obey. I say it probably every week. That's the message. Trust God and obey God. And that's what Abraham did, and that's why God blessed him. If you trust God and obey God, God will bless you. And so we see that here once again. Okay, so verse 6. So Isaac lived in Gerar. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, she is my sister. For he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. And it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister? And Isaac said to him, because I said, lest I die on account of her. And Abimelech said, what is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. Now Isaac sowed in that land. Well, let me just stop there for a second. So certainly, should be reminiscent, right? This is like time number 3. It's like, how many times is going to... I mean, twice Abraham did this, lying about his wife, right? And twice he brought God's, if you will, plan to the brink of extinction as the line was almost cut off as his wife was taken by Pharaoh and by Abimelech. And now Isaac does the same thing as his dad. Well, like father, like son, I guess. Once again, kind of the same point, just God is preserving them, even despite their lack of trust. It's just shocking that the same thing. And since we've spent so long, you know, talking about the lessons from the two times previous, it's really just the same thing, right? When you don't trust, same lesson. When you don't trust and you lie and you deceive or whatever you do that you think, you know, you need to help God out or whatever, you in one sense bring God's plan to the brink of extinction. And Abimelech here is the righteous one, and Isaac isn't. And it's, just shocking.
Is this the same Abimelech that dealt with Abraham?
Good question. Maybe. There's two options. You really only have two options. Either it's the same Abimelech. Yeah, exactly. It's either it's the same Abimelech, and 75 years... basic, roughly, from what I've read,
right,
is the time span. So either, you know, he was 30, he was young then, and now he's older.
Yeah.
You know, so, but Abraham lived quite a while, so that's possible. Or it's possible that Abimelech was a title, like Pharaoh, in which case, you know, it just kind of, Abimelech literally means my father is king. So it could be a title. So... can't answer it.
Because this...
What's that?
It could be Abimelech Jr.
Yeah, it could be Abimelech the second.
Well, with Abraham, it was Abimelech himself that almost fell.
Yeah.
Right? And here he's just saying somebody in our country could have been.
Right.
You know, so...
Yeah.
He might have been past his, you know...
Was Abraham along with
female chasing years?
Yeah.
Same place.
Same place. So, I mean, it's either the same guy or son, probably, you know. So no way to answer it really, but it's either way, it's just shocking. It's like father like son, same exact thing happens. Similar lesson. But let's just keep going on, because I love the rest of this chapter. There's a lot here for us. So I think we've sufficiently covered that, just seeing those lessons over and over, but it's amazing. But it puts us back in this scene where, once again, he's with these Philistines, he's with these pagans, if you will, and that's what's really going to set the scene for the part that follows. Now, Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in that same year a hundredfold, for Yahweh had blessed him. Right? Once again, God's blessing is transferred to Isaac. Despite his lack of faith, various things, right? God is blessing Isaac amazingly because he's the son of promise. What did God promise? I will bless those who bless you. You know, God is bringing about his plan. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he became extremely rich. Three times it's like, well, great is literally what it says. But he became great and became greater until he became extremely great. You can't miss the point, right? God is just abundantly, exceedingly blessing Isaac. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them with dirt. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are too powerful for us." And Isaac departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. Then Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistine had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the same names which his father had given them. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek, because they contended with him. Esek means contention. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too, so they named it Sitnah, which actually comes from the same root as Satan, who is the adversary. So it means like adversary or adversary. And so he moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it, so he named it Rehoboth. For he said, "At last Yahweh has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." So obviously Rehoboth there means room. You know, so the first two wells, he basically names quarrel and adversity. You know, and the last one he finally names room, because finally God gives him room. But just want to point out before we continue on and finish with this story, a couple points here. It's obvious here that God is just blessing Isaac in everything he does. Right, it's like he's multiplying him massively. He's everywhere he goes to dig a well, it's like water, you know. I don't know that much about the geography during those days, but I don't think that was probably all that common. But it seems like it's just bam, well, water, bam. It's like they keep stopping him up, and God is just blessing him to such an extent that they have to like kick him out. They're recognizing his blessing. And so we'll see, once again, just this interaction, just like we saw with Abraham, this interaction with the world around him. And certainly here, we have this antagonism because of how God is blessing Isaac so greatly. So keep that in mind, because we're gonna see the other aspects of it, where ultimately they're going to be forced to recognize this blessing and to succumb to it, if you will, which is so much of the lesson for the Israelites, is that was God's plan for them. That he would bless them so abundantly that the nations could not deny it, but would ultimately have to, you know, seek the Israelites to be a part of that blessing. And so that's the kind of theme that the author is showing here as we see this story unfold. Okay, any questions? We'll tie all this kind of together as we finish up the chapter. But any questions before we move on? Right. Then he went up from there to Beersheba, and Yahweh appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." Once again, it's all because of Abraham. And God just continues to reassure and reaffirm and reestablish the fact that God is going to fulfill his promise to Abraham through his seed. Over and over, just keeps reaffirming it. It's all because of Abraham's sake. It's you know, we saw it in Abraham's life, right? God said, this will not fail. I swear. Right? When God swears, you better be pretty convinced that it's going to happen. And so it all goes back to the covenant made with Abraham. And so he built an altar there and called on the name of Yahweh and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now, I love how this story kind of ends, because you start off with the conflict. You start off with God's blessing that results in this conflict. But look at how it finishes off. Verse 26. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Ahuzath and Pichol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you? And they said, we see plainly that Yahweh has been with you. So he said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you. And literally, let there be a curse between us. In other words, if you don't keep your side of the treaty, your side of the covenant, let there be a curse on you. And that's kind of the idea of covenant curse, right? We enter into this agreement, and as long as we keep this agreement, we'll be blessed. But as soon as one person violates the covenant, violates the agreement or the treaty, it's like cursings on them. And so that's kind of the idea here. Verse 29, that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now blessed of Yahweh. It's kind of funny. Seems like they've kind of changed their tune a little bit. Right? And at first they're kicking them out and they're disputing with them. And now they're like, we did nothing but good to you. We want to be on your side. We want to be in a treaty with you. Let's make an agreement. And I think the lesson is obvious, right? God blesses his people. And in this case, even despite some of his failings and failures, but God is going to bless his people. And that's his goal, is to bless them and to bless the world through them. And so here, even these pagans are forced to admit God's blessing upon Isaac and to, if you will, participate in that blessing. They're like, all right, we got to go to him. We got to be a part of this. We can't be fighting against what's happening here. It's obvious that God is blessing him. I mean, they admit, verse 29, you are now blessed of Yahweh. They can't escape the fact. There's no denying it. And once again, it ties in, that's God's purpose for Israel. That's how God wanted to save the world, right? That was God's original intent for them. We'll see it, in 10 years when we get to Deuteronomy, right? I mean, God says, if you obey me, I will bless you, and I'll make you the greatest nation on earth so that the whole world will see me through you. That's his plan. And certainly that's the lesson that God is really trying to drill into these Israelites all the way back here with Abraham and Isaac. When Isaac and Jacob, when Abraham and Isaac in this case received God's blessing, the world was forced to acknowledge it. The world was forced to, in one sense, seek God through them, seek peace with them. There's no escaping it. And so that is such a major lesson for the Israelites and even for us, right? God wants to bless his people and to ultimately have his people be the light to the world. And so we just always need to keep that perspective in mind. That's what God is seeking to accomplish. And so it's just awesome how these people that kicked him out, and even Isaac says, what are you guys doing here? You guys hate me. You know? He's like, you hate me. But yet they're like, no, we don't hate you. You're blessed. It's obvious that God is blessing you. And so verse 30, he made them a feast, and they ate and drank, and early in the morning they rose and exchanged oaths, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Right? Here's what's the picture? Isaac living in peace with the pagans around him. They're forced to acknowledge his blessing. And it came about on the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, we have found water. So he called it Shibah. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. All right, so any thoughts just from chapter 26 there. It's amazing to see just God's blessing and how that impacted the world around him even. It's a great lesson for us as well. We need to just take these things to heart and realize how God wants us to be impacting the world around us. And that's the lesson, right? That's God's plan for the world. You know, his plan for the world hasn't changed. His plan is still to bless the world through the descendant of Abraham. And so when we see God blessing and working and powerfully in a different way maybe than he does today, you know, with the wells and with the livestock and all that, but the point is still the same, that God uses us and wants us to be light to the world around us. That's his plan. That's his purpose. And so for myself, it's amazing to see how the book of Genesis inspires me to be about the gospel and to be about world mission. That certainly was God's purpose and plan. Okay?
Certainly see a lot of God's mercy.
Yep.
I mean, all along.
Yeah. Absolutely, even to these pagans, right? They, in one sense, got to participate in the blessings because of Isaac, to
yeah,
some
but
degree.
I mean, we keep seeing human failures.
Right.
You know? And we, I think it's like natural to say, why'd you do that? That was stupid. But we do a lot of stupid stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, in retrospect, don't laugh, Jamie. Mm-hmm. I speak from personal experience. No, God is merciful.
Yeah.
You know, and you wonder, well, okay, okay, well, we're his children, how come he doesn't spank us a little more?
No, it's amazing. You're right. I mean, the more you read through this, you see both the triumphs and the failures of these patriarchs. And yet God still uses them. And especially, you know, we've looked more at Abraham than we have yet of Jacob and Isaac. But you see his amazing triumphs of faith, but you see his failures too. And ultimately what pleases God is faith and trust in him. And we see that message coming out very clearly too. Okay, so as you come now to verse 34, I would say that verse 34 and 35 really brackets chapter 27, because it's talking about Esau's wives. And if you go to chapter 28, you'll notice that chapter 28, the first 9 verses are about Esau's wives as well. And so bracketing chapter 27 is 2 verses on the front and about 9 on the back about Esau's wives. And so it kind of brackets this section. Okay, and so when Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Just kind of this side comment. Once again, you know, just the worldly character, I guess, if you will, of Esau, that he didn't marry, I guess if you could put it this way, godly women. He married the women of the land, the Canaanite. Technically, they're not Canaanites, but they're Hittites. But obviously, we saw how Abraham did not want Isaac to marry one of the people around him because they were obviously just known for their just wickedness. And that's why God later is going to wipe them out. But certainly here, you have Esau marrying just the women of the land, and just once again, another spot on blemish on his character. So as we come to chapter 27, we hit on the major story here within this saga. Obviously, we know it as the story of Jacob and Esau and the deception there. So we'll pick it up. And just as we saw before, we already pointed out a lot of these lessons, so we don't need to necessarily, you know, go into great detail. But, you know, no one's a hero in this story. You got Jacob and Esau and Isaac and Rebekah, and all four of them aren't doing what they should have. And the result of it all is separation and pain and heartache, right? And God, yes, is still gonna accomplish what he said. He's still going to accomplish his purpose. But you can't help but think that there was a heck of a lot easier way to get there than the way that they chose to go. In other words, you see as a result of their actions how Jacob has to flee He probably never sees his mother again until she dies before he sees her again. He's off in, for 20 years in the other country because he's got to flee, and just because of all this mess that's created by a lack of trusting in God. And when people don't trust in God, there's repercussions, but God still keeps his word. And that's so much of the lesson of this, is they don't, as much as, you keep seeing it looks like God's plan is going to be foiled. This is, you talk about God's mercy, but you also just see God's perseverance and his faithfulness. You read through this book, the book of Genesis, and you see so many, just mistakes after mistakes, lying and cheating and stealing and all this. It's like, it's a miracle that God did anything through this at all. But God's plan continues to, and really that's the whole story of the Old Testament, right? How many times did the nation of Israel just continue to fail and fail and fail? But God's plan continues on. God's plan does not fail. God's promises do not fail. He always brings it about. And so that's, I think, a major lesson of this, is even in the midst of everyone's sin, God is still bringing about his plan and purpose. All right, so let's dive in. Chapter 27. Now it came about when Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see that he called his older son Esau and said to him, "My son." He said to him, "Here I am." And Isaac said, "Behold, now I am old and I do not know the day of my death. Now then, please take your gear, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare a savory dish for me as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, so that my soul may bless you before I die." Now, right off the bat, I never really thought about this before I, started studying this, but Isaac, what does he do? What does he do here? Good, bad, indifferent? Yeah, I mean, you would think that, he heard God say the older will serve the younger. You'd think that he would be wanting to bless the younger. But it seems that he's more driven by something that Esau was driven by earlier. Food. Right? It seems like, and that's the emphasis throughout here, is like, Isaac loved tasty food. Right? And so that's what's driving him. And so, seems like, now once again, he's one of the patriarchs, but you see his failures, right? And we just talked about God's grace. I think that's kind of like, all right, mistake number one. So pick up in verse 5. And Rebekah was listening while Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Behold, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, saying, 'Bring me some game and prepare me a savory dish for me that I may eat and bless you in the presence of Yahweh before my death. Now, therefore, my son, listen to me as I command you. Go now to the flock and bring me 2 choice kids from there that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall bring it to your father that he may eat, so that he may bless you before his death.' And Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, 'Behold, Esau my brother is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, then I shall be as a deceiver in his sight, and I shall bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing.' But his mother said to him, 'Your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go get them for me.' So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and his mother made savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her elder son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids on the hands and on the smooth part of his neck. She also gave the savory food and the bread which she had made to her son Jacob. Then he came to his father and said, 'My father,' and he said, 'Here I am. Who are you, my son?' And Jacob said to his father, 'I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you have told me. Get up, please, sit, and eat of my game, that you may bless me.' And Isaac said to his son, 'How is it that you have so quickly, my son?' And he said, 'Because Yahweh your God caused it to happen to me.' Then Isaac said to Jacob, 'Please come close, that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not.' So Jacob came close to Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" And he said, "I am." So he said, "Bring it to me and I will eat of my son's game that I may bless you." And he brought it to him and he ate. He also brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Please come close and kiss me, my son." So he came close and kissed him, and when he had smelled the smell of his garments, so he blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which Yahweh has blessed. Now may God give you the dew of heaven, and of the fatness of the earth, and an abundance of grain and new wine. May people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and blessed be those who bless you." So there we have it. Jacob has deceived his father. And I don't know if you caught that, but he flat out outright lied to him. I mean, just bold-faced several times there. Even to the point of in verse 20, Isaac's like, "How did you do it so quick?" And Jacob's like, just lying through his teeth, "Yahweh blessed me, Yahweh made me to get this food so fast and that I was able to bring it to you." And so obviously he has thoroughly deceived his father. And just once again, certainly his mother put him up to it, and certainly she knew the oracle. She heard this revelation of God, and she should have trusted that God would indeed bless and do as he has said. But instead, she decides to take it into her own hands. And so, she sets out this plan of deception, and once again, Jacob thoroughly deceives his father, and in the process, receives the blessing of God. And so you see once again that God accomplishes what he said he was going to accomplish, but as a result, we'll see the painful results of this in a second, but as a result, he's going to be banished from his family and from his homeland. And so, ultimately the lesson is he should have trusted God. There was a better way for him to be blessed than this. And we don't know how it would have happened. It may have taken God sending an angel and saying, "Jacob, you're blessing the wrong person here. Isaac, you're blessing the wrong person here. You should have blessed Jacob instead of Esau." We don't know how God would have accomplished it.
Well, see, that's what's in the back of my mind now. I agree with you, Rebecca and Jacob here were, stinkers. But I don't see why Isaac couldn't have blessed Esau and still have it come out in the end.
What do you mean? Well,
eventually bring the blessing upon.
Well,
Jacob.
You have to understand how blessings work in the Old Testament. When Isaac blesses his son, it's not just like a wish. Okay, like this blessing is not just like blessings upon you. May this happen to you. You'll see in just a little bit here that this blessing is going to come about. It's authoritative. It's like, in other words, when Esau comes in and finds out that the blessing should have gone, that his blessing went to Jacob, he's like, "Father, why don't you just give me a blessing too?" And Jacob and Isaac, man, I'm confusing all the characters here. Isaac says, "I can't do it. Can't do it. The blessing's already gone out. In this blessing, it's almost like a prayer to God that, God, may you do this." And because God doesn't change, this blessing can't be revoked. In other words, I guess that's probably the best way to put it. Blessings are irrevocable. It's somewhat of an authoritative...
Statute.
What's that?
Permanent statute?
Yeah, it's permanent. Yeah, and so you see in here that in this blessing that Jacob thought he was giving to Esau, he made Jacob serve Esau, but in fact he was tricked, and so therefore he made Esau serve Jacob. You see that?
Okay.
So in other words, in this blessing, Isaac is saying, may Esau be the blessed son through whom everyone else is subjected. May those who bless you be blessed. May people serve. May you be the blessed nation. But because of Jacob's deception, that's turned upside down to where he is going to be the nation who is blessed. He is going to be. Now, obviously, it came in fulfillment of God, what God said at the beginning, but he got there through deception. Right? And so he undermined what he sought to do, and he and Rebekah both sought to attain what they knew was set out for them in the first place, but they didn't trust God for it. They got there by deception. And so, once again, it's this, no one is in the right here. Certainly, Isaac, even there, Isaac is blessed. And maybe you could say that Isaac was in the clear, but certainly, certainly Jacob and Rebekah are seeking to attain God's blessing and what God already said he was going to do, but they did it through deceitful means. And it's pretty shocking here how the whole thing turns out. And once again, the message is that we need to trust God for his blessings his way. He's going to bring about what he says he's going to do. And so as verse 30 continues on, now it came about as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had hardly gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from his hunting. Then he also made savory food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me." And Isaac his father said to him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am your son, your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who is he that hunted game and brought it to me, so that I ate of all of it before you came and had blessed him? Yes, and he shall be blessed." In other words, he puts that little parenthetical statement. It's like, the blessing's already gone out. I can't undo it. And so when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, my father." And he said, "Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." Then he said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. When he says, 'Have you not reserved a blessing for me?' But Isaac answered and said to Esau, 'Behold, I have made him your master, and all his relatives I have given to him. Sorry, and all his relatives I have given to him as servants, and with grain and new wine I have sustained him. Now as for you then, what can I do, my son?'" In other words, he's bound by his own blessing. "And Esau said to his father, 'Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me, O my father.' So Esau lifted his voice and wept. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, 'Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, and away from the dew of the heavens from above. And by your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. But it shall come about when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck.'" Quite a blessing he receives, right? The commentator I read called it an anti-blessing, right? Because the blessing has already gone to Jacob. And so, once again, it's binding in a sense, and there's nothing left for Isaac to bless Esau with. And so, God brought about what he said he would bring about, but yet in the means by which it was brought about was due to this deception of Jacob. And yet, because of that deception, we're going to see the painful results to the family, where the family gets torn apart because of the results. And so, you know, once again, they should have trusted God. God would have brought it about some other way. We don't know how. But that's why when Abraham's put in a similar situation, what does he say? It's like, "I don't know how you're going to do it, God. You're going to send an angel. You're going to work some miracle somehow." And that's the lesson for us, right? When you're put into a situation that seems impossible, you know, Isaac is bent on blessing Esau, and yet Rebekah knows that God's plan is something else. You know, it seems impossible. What do you do in those kind of impossible situations? What do you do when you don't know if, you know, you go thousands of miles to get a wife for your son, and you don't know if she's going to come back? What do you do when Lot is given the, you know, Lot and Abraham have this choice of the better land, You know, do you give him the better choice and maybe he'll even take the promised land, or do you trust in God and rely upon the fact that God will do what he has said? He will keep his promises. And so you see both aspects of that coming through the book of Genesis. You have the great examples where Abraham and others, they do the irrational thing. They do the thing that's not logical. They give the better choice to the other person, and even in one sense risk giving up the promised land itself because they so intently hold to and depend upon God's promise. But here you have the exact opposite. Jacob wanted the result of the blessing, but he didn't trust God to get it. And so he deceived and tricked in order to get it. And so we'll see the result of what happened because of that. Right?
You know, when we mentioned the question of the difference in birthright, how come he mentions it twice, like he says, he took away my birthright and now he has taken away my blessing?
Right.
Why is he referred to them as almost separate things? Or am I...
No, they are separate.
Okay.
They are separate. The birthright has to do with heirship, and blessing is kind of this, you know, the patriarchs, many of them, at the end of their lives, they give this blessing. And it's kind of a, I don't know how to say it, but it's kind of this prayer of faith for their son. It's this final prayer of faith. And so it is these two separate things, but they're intricately tied, because in the promise is that this heir would come forth, this line would come forth. So the heirship has to do with the promise and the blessing. They're all kind of intricately tied together, that God's plan is to send blessing through Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob, to the nation of Israel. And so that it has to do with heirship. It also has to do with blessing, right? That's God's line, that's God's promise way of bringing this blessing to the world. In other words, you can only have one chosen line, right? And so the heir also probably implied as heir to the promises, right? And so it all got to go together. The blessing, the promises, the nation of Israel, the line, it all ties together. But they are two distinct aspects of it. That's a good question. And so then as you come to verse 41, the result, so Esau bore a grudge against Jacob. Surprise, surprise, right? I mean, twice he got ousted, tricked, deceived by his brother because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are near, then I will kill my brother Jacob." Right? I mean, he's hurt to the core. Now, when the words of her elder son Esau were reported to Rebekah, she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you." In other words, he's comforting himself with the thought of killing his brother. Because obviously he is so upset and just out of sorts by this. "And so now, therefore, my son, obey my voice and arise. Flee to Haran, to my brother Laban, and stay with him a few days until your brother's fury subsides." And as I think, I don't know who pointed that out, maybe Ethan did, but that few days turns into 20 years that he's exiled from his family. And like I said, his mother, and as a result of her deceit, you know, and her planning and scheming, her beloved son she'll never see again. You'll never see again her beloved son as a result of this. And until your brother's anger against you subsides and he will forget what he did, what you did to him, then I shall send and get you from there. Why should I be bereaved of both of you both in one day? And Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth like these, from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me?" And so now she's enacting her second plan, which is sending Jacob out to her relatives. Okay? And so verse 28, "So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, 'You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May also give you the blessing of Abraham, to you and to your seed with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham. Then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, son of Bethuel the Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. Now Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram to take to himself a wife from there, and that when he blessed him, he charged him, saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." And that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac, and Esau went to Ishmael and married, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nabaioth. And so, kind of the separation is complete. As a result of the deception and the not trusting in God, finally Jacob is going to be sent away. And so, you see here, though, that Isaac is blessing his son. And now, as a result of what has transpired, even though it wasn't done the right way, Isaac blesses his son, and Isaac, I guess, at least at this point, understands that Jacob is going to be the one through whom God's blessing flows. And so he says, may you have the blessing of Abraham. May God make you fruitful and a mighty nation. And he blessed him and sent him away. But then on the flip side, Esau and his, you know, Canaanite wives are displeasing. And so just again, the contrast between Jacob and Esau. Okay, so that verse 9 there ends this whole story. And so you see the deceit, you see the trickery that is brought out, you see the results of it. And once again, just the lesson is we need to trust in God. God always keeps his promises. You can rely upon it. You can always depend upon the fact that God will keep his word. Okay, now I want to finish this next section as well before we close, because this kind of we're about to change scenes as Jacob goes to be with Laban. And so this is kind of a transitionary scene. So it's a great lesson for us. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went towards Haran. And he came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. And he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, Yahweh stood above it and said, "I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely Yahweh is in this place, and I did not know it." And he was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." So Jacob arose in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it. And he called on the name of that, and he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then Yahweh will be my God. And this stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And of all that thou dost give me, I will surely give a tenth to thee." All right, keep the picture here. You know, in light of everything that's happened, Jacob, in spite of all this deception, God still reaffirms and reassures him that he's the one through whom this blessing is going to come, right? God's plan cannot fail, even in spite of all this. And this is just a key moment as Jacob is getting kicked out. There's certainly the temptation to think, well, maybe I don't know what's going to happen. And so God just comes in this, in one sense, this low point in his life and reassures him that he is going to be with him. and that he reassures him of the promises, and of the promise to Abraham, which will be to him, that he will be with him. And that's really even the expansion upon the Abrahamic promise here, is that not only the previous promises made to Abraham are reaffirmed here, but also God says to Jacob, I will be with you. Just an awesome promise of God's presence. And so as a result, Jacob worships God in this place and makes this vow that, you know, as he leaves on this journey, if he returns to this place, that... Now, I would probably translate this different. I would probably translate verse 21 as still part of the if. You know, if I return in safety to my father's house, and if Yahweh is my God, then this stone which I have set up will be God's house, and all that thou dost give me, I will surely give thee a tenth. In other words, he says, if God blesses me, and if I go on this journey and return, and God has been with me, then I will give God a tenth of everything, and I will worship God again in this place. And so you see God coming in at this pivotal, in this pivotal time in the life of Jacob, and reassuring him of all the promises that despite everything that's happened, God's plan hasn't failed. But God has chosen this line sovereignly, and he is going to bring about his plan to bless the world. So we continue on. We'll continue on next week. But a lot of great lessons, right? Just what we've already seen. Just to continue to trust and obey God. To be sure that whatever he said, he will do. That, and as outrageous as it may appear or seem, that God's going to bring it about. And then the call for us is to wait on God and to trust in God. And not to try to take things into our own hands, because we know that God's word will never fail. And we just glory in the fact that God's plan charges down and continues on and is never thwarted. So great, great lessons for us. Okay, any other closing thoughts or questions?
I was thinking that his anti-blessing for Esau is kind of, well, maybe a way of saying, Isaac is saying, what I've done and I've done, but this is the way God wants it, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
And that he's like kind of sealing,
yeah,
Esau. It's a double-sided,
right,
you know, I mean, going back to what you were saying, if Isaac was wrong in going forward with the blessing,
mm-hmm,
and planning it himself,
mm-hmm,
maybe that was his way of saying, no, Esau,
right,
this is the way it has to be.
And it certainly, at least at that point, he recognized, you know.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like it's too late. He recognized from then on out, he's supportive of Jacob. You know, and certainly he didn't want to initially. I mean, when he finds out that he blessed the wrong son, he about had a heart attack. I mean, he starts shaking violently. You know, so that certainly wasn't his desire. But at least at that point, he recognized that that's what God's will was,
right,
and that's what,
yeah,
God's direction was. Absolutely.
It seems like at the end, Jacob's not even like very thankful, or I mean, he's kind of like, if God does this and this, then he'll be my God, and then I'll submit to him or give,
right,
it back to him, kind of.
I think he's still kind of conniving,
you know, like kind of bargaining almost.
Yeah.
And I think
we're not going to see the turnaround in Jacob's life until he wrestles with God. I mean, he's going to be conniving Laban, stealing from Laban, right? We continue to see that, you know, God is going to bless him because God is going to keep his promise and his word. But I think that's a great point. I don't think Jacob ever kind of turns around till, well, the end, closer to the end at least. And so that's why this story doesn't really sit well with us. It's like, well, he got the blessing, but was that good? You know, it's like, because he didn't do it the right way, and there's this tension, and it's meant to be there. The author is purposefully giving us that tension and making us wrestle with it. And the beautiful thing is I think it kind of goes back to what you're saying, is it shows that in one sense, the blessing and God's plan and God's purpose doesn't depend on man. God's going to bring it about, and ultimately he does turn Jacob around. But it takes quite a bit to get there. And so you see the ill effects of it on his life and on his family because he didn't trust in God in the process. So I would agree with your comment there. He's certainly not there yet.
I was going to kind of agree with what she was saying, but it might be just a little bit more literally trying to bargain. It's like, you know, if I make it back, nobody kills me. Because his brother still hates him at this point, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's, I think it's kind of saying, you know, if I make it back, I'll do this, but then he doesn't. So, you know, it keeps getting delayed.
Right.
That's all I was going to say.
It kind of seems like the start of his possible shifting is like in verse 16, surely the Lord is in this place and I didn't know it, like after he wakes from this dream. And I kind of find that beautiful because, you know, just
it seems like when those moments in your life where you just kind of dawns on you, and yet you're still immature in your way of thinking, but you kind of realize, oh, okay, you know, this is what God is revealing to me, you know. And I mean, obviously still, he kind of seems like, it sounds like a young kid at the end. It's like, yeah, this pillar's going to be this, you know, and he's like kind of excited or something, you know, and, you know, but it's kind of like the start of his better way of thinking. It seems like it starts there. It's obviously still not there. So, it's cool.
All right. Well, let's close in prayer and we can share prayer requests and such. Our Father, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you that you have revealed it so clearly to us, your plan, your purpose, your faithfulness, that you always do exactly what you have said. And even when we don't see it, and even when it seems impossible, when we can't figure out how in the world you would bring about blessing the younger son when the father's intent on blessing the older, yet we can trust you, and we know that. And so we thank you for that, and we pray that you would teach us that, Lord, just to simply trust and obey. Lord, we pray that you would help us to get the lesson that the author just over and over and over again just keeps striving, seeking to drive home to us. Lord, and it's certainly the lesson that the Israelites needed to hear over and over again as well, Lord, that they needed to trust you and obey you and to keep your word and to know that you would do the rest. Lord, so I pray that you would apply that to our hearts as well and keep us trusting in you no matter what the circumstances. So we praise you and we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.